The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
What this show was about, and other videos were just workers describing the experiences of work, the experiences of patient, the carelessness, managing to be uses, etc. And this video had really a lot of success to social media because it was really fitting the experiences of young workers. Three contributed to radicalize people against the law, against the government, but against exploitation itself. The third aspect has been the mobilization in high school and universities. I think it was maybe the main aspect. From the beginning of March to early May, there has been almost every week one or two student demonstrations in many French cities, which took radical form since the beginning, very disruptive, very hostile to the state and to the police. You might know that one of the slogans that spread in the last month, and one maybe the most popular slogan in the demonstrations, are Tout le monde déteste la police, which simply means everybody hates the police. Most of these populations, especially in universities, have been built through democratic forms with general assemblies at the local level and meetings of elected delegates at the national level. The last aspect is that many unions, especially in the main union, which is the CGT, rank and file activists and intermediary leaderships wanted to fight against the government and against the bosses. They were very frustrated by the last 6 years in which labor struggle had been weak and isolated, which without any significant national mobilizations. So all of this really pushed the union leadership, especially in the CGT, which is still central in any attempt to build a national struggle in France. And that's one of the reasons why the CGT national leadership, especially the new general secretary, Philippe Martinez, has been much more combative than in previous years. They understood that they couldn't negotiate the content of the law because people in the streets, young people, but also many union activists, wouldn't have accepted that. It would have provoked a huge crisis within the CGT. That's why they put forward a simple and unifying demand, which was and still is the simple removal of the law. And for us, for the radical left and for union activists, it was very important that the national leadership of the CGT took that position because it was possible to build and to unify the movement upon that uncompromising demand, which was understandable at a large scale. Even if we have to say that the CGT leadership didn't really help rank and file activists to build and to spread the strike, mostly didn't block it, except in the railway sector where the CGT bureaucracy played a very conservative role. My first point is about the three different forms that the movement took. The first two are really classical means of protest, strikes and free demonstrations. Demonstrations during the work week, but also during the weekend to allow people that cannot go on strike, especially precarious workers, to demonstrate. But another means of protest has been squares of occupations under the name of Nuit Debout, which means up all night, very much inspired by the Spanish example. Again, this wasn't started by union bureaucracy or by political parties, but this was initiated by social movement activists, rank and file activists, and by a newspaper called Fakir, which has a radical reformist orientation. These people were just saying, we're going to demonstrate on the 21st of March, but instead of going home at the end of the demo like we usually do, we should occupy Republic Square, which is one of the main squares in Paris. So this initiative quickly spread all over the country in more than 100 cities of France. In Paris, there has been like between 500 people and 2,000 or 3,000 people every day. The first important thing about Nuit Debout is that it gave the opportunity for many people who are mostly not members of political parties or unions, mostly young qualified workers who experienced precariousness or unemployment. It really gave them the opportunity to organize and to discuss politically, not only about the law, but also about almost everything, every political question. Obviously, how to win against the government, why a general strike is necessary and how to build it, but also like who decides in this society, is it really a democracy? What should we do to preserve the environment? What should be our fundamental demands, our political project, etc.? So as a result, through Nuit Debout, tens of thousands of people have experienced what could be a genuine democracy, what can be politics, when it's made not by the ruling class for their interests. You hear me?
Yep, you're doing great.
not by the ruling class for their interest, but from below, by the large majority of people, by ordinary people. And this experience is surely something that is going to leave some marks in the next months and years, and something that the radical left could build on. Even if obviously there were a lot of limits in it, and on how to relate to working class neighborhoods, how to deal with gender and racial oppression, what should be our positions on violence in front of the police, should we let reactionary people participate to assemblies, etc. I'm sure that you experienced that in the Occupy movement, by the way. Another important aspect of the movement is that when the group got a bit weaker at the end of May, even if there's still hundreds of people who are gathering in squares, a movement of strike emerged in several strategic sectors, especially the railway sector, the refineries, the seaports, the sanitation, the nuclear power stations, etc. For a lot of people, it appeared that as a kind of rebirth of the industrial working class as a social force. And it's quite easy to see that this movement began to scare the government a lot, especially with the soccer European Championship that began in the beginning of June. Mainstream media, bosses, and politicians became extremely aggressive against the strikes and against unions in general. For instance, the head of the bosses' organizations, but also a few journalists, compared the CGT with ISIS, saying that unions were taking the French population hostage, or saying that France was facing two main threats, ISIS and the CGT. To go back to the strikes, the problem is that they have mostly been forming unions, bastions, and the movement didn't succeed to spread the strikes to other sectors, like it did, for instance, in May 68. And it seems that the government will not remove the law unless there's a real blockade of the economy, that is to say, a general strike. My fifth point is about the democratic question that has been raised constantly by the movement, especially because the government, which had no majority in the parliament to pass the law, used a special procedure to impose it, what we call the 49-3 procedure. The democratic question is actually central in French politics right now, because there has been an authoritarian turn in France in the last 10 years, and this turn was clearly accelerated in the last 6 months. For instance, last week the government first tried to ban the union's demonstrations against the law. This provoked a huge public scandal, so they moved backwards, but it would have been the first union demonstration banned since the 1962 demonstrations against the war in Algeria, in which 9 activists had been killed. In particular, the government used the terrorist attacks in last November to implement a repressive agenda that they had already in mind before the attacks. In other words, to reinforce the repressive apparatus of the state against the worker struggles, but also against Muslims, against migrants, against ecological struggles, and against people living in working class neighborhoods. It's another example, I would say, of what Naomi Klein has called the shock strategy, which means using the astonishment provoked by a catastrophe or by terrorist attacks to implement policies that would have been very difficult to impose in other times. At a general level, this authoritarian turn can be understood as a ruling class answer to the very deep and lasting political crisis in France, to the incapacity of the dominant parties to win to actually win the active consent of people to the neoliberal agenda. More concretely, the logic of the state of emergency has been to extend to the whole society the kind of state control and violence that was already targeting working class neighborhoods and non-white people. And by the way, we have to remind that when the first demonstrations were banned 2 years ago, these were demonstrations against the Israeli attacks on Gaza, and most of those who were demonstrating were young and non-white people coming from these working class neighborhoods. But at that time, the large majority of the workers' movement didn't show any concrete solidarity with the pro-Palestinian movement. Only a few organizations of the radical left, Ensemble and the NPA, appealed to the banned demonstrations. But right now, the simple fact that millions of people have been demonstrating for the last 3 months, that so many people confronted the police so many times, like there has been like 20 or 25 demonstrations, a police that has been more violent and provocative than ever in the last 20 years. This simple fact is extremely important politically, because it says we won't accept the denial of our basic democratic rights, especially the right to demonstrate or to strike. We won't let you destroy these rights. My last point is about the perspectives of the for the movement right now. We could have thought that the movement was going to slow down a bit with the use of the special procedure I talked about, to impose the law, with the European Soccer Championship too, and with the criminalization of the movement. But in the middle of June, 1 million people, more than 1 million people, marched in the streets of Paris, and there were several big demonstrations in other cities like Marseille or Toulouse. This was the biggest demonstration in Paris since the beginning of the movement, even if it's still quite far from the biggest demonstrations in 2010. Another very good sign is that there's still a majority of the population, 65% according to polls, who is against the reform and who supports the movement, which is quite surprising because the movement and the media have done everything they could in the last few months to make the movement illegitimate. I think the question right now in the movement is not about being optimistic or pessimistic. We will see what's going to happen in the next weeks. But what is quite clear to me is that this movement opens huge opportunities for the present, and for the future. It creates the possibility of a new beginning for the radical left and for the workers' movement. As I said before, there's less people in the streets than during the 2010 movement, especially because some unions, like the CFDT, support the reform, and the CFDT is one of the two main unions in France. But the movement is way more radical and more militant because it's based on strikes and squares of patients, while the 2010 movement was built upon isolated days of demonstrations. The strikes were quite weak, apart from the refineries, and the agenda of the movement had been completely controlled by the union's bureaucracy, which is not the case this year. To conclude, I would say that three elements are very important to think about French radical politics in the next months and years. First element is that the common sense of the movement, not only in Ribeauvillé, but the whole movement, has been very close to far-left positions and is much more radical than it was during the anti-globalization movement in the years 2000. The necessity of a convergence of different struggles, the centrality of the strikes in order to win, the hostility towards the police, the anti-capitalist feelings of hundreds of thousands of people, while 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of people were simply against the excesses of neoliberalism, and last but not least, the radical distrust towards the Socialist Party, at the point that the Socialist Party just announced that they will simply cancel their summer school because they fear violence against it. The second element is that we've seen the emergence of a new political generation in that struggle. Really not the same generation that led the mass struggles between 1995 and 2010. This is obviously true for the movement in high schools and universities, but also in Ribeauvillé and also in union struggles, where the large majority of activists are quite young and not organically linked to any kind of political organization. And the last element is about one central weakness of the movement and of the radical left in France, which is the incapacity for the moment to take seriously the question of racism and to develop an anti-racist agenda connected to the existing struggles on this front. Against Islamophobia, which is endemic, as you may know, in French society and politics, against police violence, against discrimination and segregation, etc. And if we want to build a connection between struggles on the workplace and struggles on working class neighborhoods, the radical left and the workers' movement have to be much more active and radical against racism. Otherwise, it will be very easy in the next years for the ruling classes to divide us along racial lines. Thanks.
So, you know, Ugo just went through basically everything, and I'm not quite sure what to add, but maybe for an American audience, I'll try and give a little bit of background and explain some of the things that Ugo was talking about so usefully right there. So first, France is a country in Europe, and that is on the other side of the ocean. No, I'm just kidding. I was saving that one just for this meeting. So, I mean, obviously people have seen that since February, when this law was announced, the Loi El Khomri, as it's known in France after the labor minister, Myriam El Khomri, there's been this real escalation of struggle over the last couple of months. And it's something that Ugo and I have talked about in the past, that seen in retrospect, you could kind of see the buildup of the social tensions that have been expressed in this kind of explosion. But, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and I don't think anyone saw this coming in response to this law. In fact, when I was in France at the end of last year, and I was interviewing people on the left and labor leaders and people on the right, actually, and asked whether this sort of thing was still possible, a lot of people said, well, probably not. Because in France, there was, as Hugo was talking about, a whole period of social struggles in the 1990s, and that really, in the 15 years after the December 1995 strike wave against Juppé's proposed pension reform, the public sector strikes, which were very strong in the rail sector particularly, there was a whole series of social struggles that were, and political struggles, that were really, really intense, and there were, you know, I think several generations of activists that emerged out of those. And then in the fall of 2010, another proposed pension reform, this one proposed by the then president Sarkozy, who was a right-wing president, sparked a movement that was really enormous in the way that Hugo was talking about. I mean, millions and millions of people were out on the streets, and people might have seen, anyone who was paying attention to French television in the fall of 2010, which I know as many of you, you know, you would have seen pictures of the fires, you know, the refineries with the workers out front burning stuff, and you're going, oh wow, this looks very, you know, very radical, very militant, and it just got totally defeated. That Sarkozy basically said, that's great, it's wonderful you're out on demonstrations, and I'm just going to ignore you, and I'm going to push through this law. And that defeat had really significant repercussions for the French left and for the French labor movement. And I think a lot of people afterwards were not sure whether the kinds of dynamics you saw during that cycle of struggle, this period where, you know, governments were trying to push through reforms of the labor law, of the welfare state, always had to be worried that there was going to be this kind of massive social explosion. People weren't sure whether that was possible anymore. And obviously we've seen that it is. And you know, in the law, and we can go through in the discussion period too some of the details of the law, and it includes a lot of different provisions. We'll do a whole bunch of different things. You know, some of the most important ones is that it will already undermine the rules on working time. France technically has a 35-hour work week that was passed at the end of the 1990s. That's kind of gotten chipped away at. This would further chip it away. It would make it much easier to fire people, you know, for companies that, you know, in France, there are restrictions on, on layoffs, basically, and this would ease those restrictions. It would reduce the compensation people would get if they got laid off, and you know, and if you're laid off in France, you know, and you're fired without just cause, you're allowed to pursue compensation via French labor courts. Well, this would reduce the amount you could get back quite considerably, and you know, there are a whole bunch of other provisions. I think the most fundamental provisions, you know, the key to what the law is trying to do is a set of provisions that would massively increase the scope and the ease of what are called company level agreements. These agreements that are negotiated by management inside every firm. And the reason that that's so important is that traditionally in the French labor market, in the employment structure, the way employment was regulated was from the labor code, the encompassing labor code, down through the traditional sector level collective bargaining system. In France, traditionally, collective bargaining happens not at the company, at the firm level, but within each sector. And then within that, you know, increasingly since the beginning of the 1980s, there's been gradually an expansion of these firm-level negotiations, and this would really shift the locus of regulation down to the firm level. In France, they talk about it as reversing the hierarchy of norms. So rather than going from labor law down, you know, you basically are going from company level agreements up. And the reason that you want to do this is because it's much, much easier for employers to force workers to sign concessionary agreements, to undermine the terms of traditional employment standards. The more decentralized collective bargaining and employment regulation is, right? And in fact, all over Europe, you've seen this kind of decentralization, this move down to the company level as a way of as a key aspect of the employer's offensive of the last couple of decades. The government is trying to push this through at a time when in France there is very, very high unemployment. You know, it's official unemployment is in double digits. For young people, it's like a quarter. There's very high rates of long-term unemployment. And since 2008, I mean, France, unlike Germany or the US, really has not recovered at all from the crisis of 2008. And you've essentially seen almost zero growth since then. I mean, there's just a little bit of job growth, and the current government is going to try and use that. But really, things have been stagnating. And the government essentially says, well, the problem is that our labor law is too rigid, and our employment regulations are too rigid, and we have to liberalize them in order to create jobs. And I think there's a lot of skepticism about that. I mean, this has been this government's strategy. Hollande was elected in 2012 on the basis, really, of being the anti-Sarkozy. He said, we're not going to do that. And almost immediately turned towards not only continuing the project of neoliberalizing reforms of the labor market and the welfare state, but really intensified it and has accelerated it. And that has not improved the economic situation of workers in France. And there's a lot of skepticism about the argument that forcing current employees to work longer hours or making it easier to lay them off is going to be like a way of creating jobs. Yeah, like there's a lot of doubt about that. And I think people see this rightly as just a way of trying to undermine employment standards and the kind of regulations that you see in France. As the government has kind of escalated that project, its poll numbers have collapsed. Like in a historically unprecedented way, Hollande is now the most unpopular president in the history of the Fifth Republic. I think his approval rating is at like 14%. It's really remarkably low. Valls, his prime minister, is just a little bit above. He's in the 20s. But you've seen a real collapse of the government, and there are elections coming up next year. And I think that there is a lot of fear, rightly, that you're going to end up in a situation in which the people who make it from the first round of the presidential election, in which lots of parties compete, to the second round, where there's the two parties, that's a runoff. It's going to be essentially the mainstream right against the far right. And really, I mean, one of the very frightening things of over the last couple of years has been the way that the Front National, that the National Front, that Marine Le Pen, who will be their presidential candidate next year, have really been able to expand their base, including moving into very traditional working class left-wing areas, like in the north of France, the historical, really a bastion of the French Socialist Party, where there's a lot of unemployment. The National Front has really been able to make inroads and build a base right there. We could talk about why if there is an election. Let's say this. I think that, and Ugo has argued with me, that there is an attempt at an electoral strategy in what the current Socialist Party government is doing. That there's a degree to which what they see themselves as doing is, by implementing these kind of reforms that have been demanded by the neoliberal right, they're kind of going to split the mainstream right, which is already divided. They're behind two different candidates: Sarkozy, the former president, who's making a comeback, and Juppé, that prime minister from the 90s, who tried to do the pension reform and failed, is now, I think he's the leading contender to emerge as to be the president after next year. He's trying to position himself as sort of the more moderate right winger. But Hollande is trying to split the right and create a situation in which it's basically the Socialist Party versus the National Front. So everyone who doesn't want to vote for Marine Le Pen will have to gravitate back to the Socialist Party. If that is the strategy, that is a failed strategy. It is not working. It is really, really not working. In fact, Hollande's poll numbers, and he's likely to run for re-election next year, are so low, he's even below the candidate of the, okay, cool, of the far left, the leading candidate from the last election, a guy named Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who ran as the candidate of the Front de Gauche, the left front, which is cracking up internally. But Mélenchon, in a lot of polls, is now ahead of Hollande, which means that, I mean, Hollande is so disappointed and really demoralized the base of the Socialist Party, that people are basically saying, I'm not going to come out for Hollande. And, you know, it's a very scary situation, which if it ends up being, you can imagine there's going to be a lot of abstention on the left in next year's presidential election because people are very disappointed, which will create space for the right. So, but the government has been, as it's escalated this attacks on the labor law reform and it's seen its poll numbers collapse, there's been a buildup of social tensions, and it's, as I said, you can kind of see some of the signs of that in retrospect. There haven't been mass demonstrations in the last couple of years in the face of some of these reforms that the government has pushed through. There has been a lot of opposition, so that the constitutional measure that Hugo described, the 49-3, which allows the government to bypass the normal parliamentary vote to push through certain types of budgetary measures, they were forced to resort to that to push through another unpopular reform last year, the Loi Macron, named after the very evil finance minister, and we have former investment banker Emmanuel Macron. So the government was forced to resort to that, and it took a further hit to its popularity because of that. And now, in this context, the context of all these protests and the widespread opposition, it looks like the government is going to be forced to resort to the 49-3 again to push through the current law. And it essentially has said, we're not backing down. We're not making any concessions on the key provisions of this. We'll try and cut some deals with some sections of the opposition around marginal aspects of the law, but the core of what we're trying to do, we are sticking to it. In fact, so the bill went through a first reading in the National Assembly. Now it goes to the Senate, and then it's going to go back to the National Assembly. To get it through the National Assembly, the first time the government was forced to use this 49-3 procedure. If it ends up having to do that to get through the bill itself, it will take such a hit. I read a poll that most French voters would support, including voters of the left, I think, would support a no-confidence vote in the government if it's forced to resort to this 49-3 measure. I mean, it really is a deeply undemocratic way of forcing through a law. I mean, we're used to lack of democracy, but what we've seen in France over the last couple of months in terms of the repression on the street, and then in terms of the way the government's like, oh, you're all against my bill? Well, you know, I don't care. We're gonna do it anyway. It's really an intensification of this turn towards sort of undemocratic, really deeply undemocratic political governance in France. In terms of the opposition itself, and the French left has had a difficult time, like I said, the last couple of years. It has not been a good time for a left that was much stronger than the left in the Anglophone world, I would say, even a decade ago, much stronger. It's still much stronger in a lot of ways, but it's been a tough time. The opposition, it's true that everything that I endorse everything that Hugo said about the trade unions, and just to give some sense of, I mean, the CGT, which was historically the communist-aligned union confederation, and France has a different system of union representation and organization, so but the union density is actually lower than in the United States, because you don't have to be in a union to be covered by a union contract. Joining a union is a bit like, it's like joining a political party, right? So there can be multiple unions represented in the same workplace. I don't mean the analogy literally, but you don't have to be a union to be covered by a union contract. So like over 90% of workers are covered by union contracts. Union density is lower than in the United States. The CGT was historically the main union in the French labor movement. In the 1980s, in the recession of the 1980s, it got absolutely hammered, lost like more than half of its membership. Really, it was severely weakened, but it's still a major force. And particularly, anytime you talk about these social explosions France has seen over the last 20 years, the CGT is inevitably going to play a crucial role in that. I mean, it is really the force that is still able to mobilize a core of the working class militants, the only force in French society. And it leads what you can think of as a wing of the labor movement, the sort of more struggle-oriented pole of the labor movement, which includes several other unions as well, and has been pretty committed, pretty adamant, and partly due to this sort of internal pressure and inside the union, but about sticking to its Yeah, pretty adamant about sticking to its guns that its demand is the withdrawal of the bill. So it wants the bill gone. No. You know, there were signals. Martinez sent signals at certain moments that he might that he might be willing to negotiate on some side things. But he the core of the bill had to go. The government said no. The core of the bill stays. So there's, you know, the CGT has been really the centerpiece of the opposition in a lot of ways, even if it didn't call this movement into being. On the other hand, there's another wing of the labor movement led by this union. Hugo talked about the CFDT, which is the more social democratic. Really, at this point, has become very conservative. Has signed a series of agreements with the government over the last 5 years on awful reforms, reform bills, and really is playing a very conservatizing role. And at this point, has kind of vacillated on the current bill, but is definitely not mobilizing people and wants to come to an accommodation with the government. And that's, in the past, that's been a difficulty, this kind of split in the labor movement, because it's allowed the government to isolate the CGT and the left and to overcome their opposition by using the more conservative wing of the labor movement. At this point, the opposition to this bill is so widespread, I mean, majority opposition, that the government has not succeeded in that way. I mean, look, what Hugo's talking about, when you have all day, every day in the press, constant coverage of how these evil protesters are breaking windows, and there are some people, some groups involved in the protests who I think you can question their tactical approach, absolutely. But the level of propaganda against the movement and against the unions has been so intense. I mean, these comparisons to ISIS, it really captures how the French bourgeoisie feels about this CGT. They're like, why won't you be reasonable and cooperate with us on this? You know, it's got to be because you're all a bunch of terrorists. There also can be a lot of racism, and because a lot of CGT members come from, you know, not a lot, but a portion come from black, or, you know, even people who wear the headscarf, which in France is very loaded. So there will be a lot of racism in the coverage of the CGT at times. But the fact that the government has not been able to totally marginalize and crush this movement is a testament to how deep the social tensions that are driving it, how deep they go. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, it's going to be hard. It's the government is saying we're going to do this, and it's going to be hard to overcome that. And there's a lot of unevenness in the movement, and it's very heavily policed. And, you know, there are a lot of questions that the movement has to answer. If somehow they were able to win a victory on this, and and the movement, Hugo's absolutely right. It's already changed the political dynamics in some very important ways. It's very inspiring. If they were able to win a victory around this, and I think it would be hard, I think it would have reverberations across Europe. And one of the things that you've seen over the, you know, since the crisis, basically, is that all over Europe, Greece, you know, Spain, Portugal, people, there's a lot of struggle. People want to struggle. There is a lot of opposition to the austerity drive, to the attempt to at neoliberal restructuring of these economies. The fact that we haven't been able to win our side significant victories, that, you know, strikes and demonstrations and has not been able to halt the course of of that neoliberal reform program is, I think it's raised a lot. There's a danger of a fatalism developing in general, you know, of people feeling like you can't do anything in the face of this tide. And so a victory here would really be enormously significant, and it's something for all of us to be paying attention to over the next month. So thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.